Welcome to The Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast, which is always available at thehollywoodoutsider.com or your favorite podcast app. This entire episode is devoted to Spider-Man: No Way Home, literally the biggest movie of the entire year. And we are forewarning you now that spoilers will be present, because we all know that with great podcast power comes great responsibility. Dad joke.
Oh my God.
Joining me today are my fellow host, Amanda Sink.
Hello.
You're starting to mess me up with this.
I'm messing myself up.
Stick to a rhythm here. And joining us, Adam Moreau from the Hollywood Outsider community member and also a friend of the show.
Good to be here, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. And you're somewhat of a comic book historian. We often fight about debate.
Yeah, we do. Historian is a very loose term, but yeah, sure.
I think these days, everybody who says they're a comic book historian, it's a loose term.
Can I just be a pop culture enthusiast? Is that better?
I think I like it. Yeah.
That was right. Fun.
Yeah. It puts less responsibility on me for...
You're like, I don't want the great responsibility.
I don't want that. Yeah.
Well, definitely we're all Spider-Man fans, and that's what matters. And we're here to talk about Spider-Man No Way Home. And we're even going to talk about my Uncle Ben problem and see if it's finally been solved.
Oh, boy.
Hey, it's an ongoing thing. It's been going on for years, and we're finally going to see if this film finally handled it. And I want to say once again, spoilers are here. We're not even going to try to dance around stuff, because I think it's too hard to really talk about this movie if you don't talk about spoilers. Everyone agree with that?
I mean, and honestly, who didn't see it this weekend already?
Apparently. I mean, 587 million at this time. It might fluctuate a little bit when you hear this, but 587 worldwide, 253 US. I said it wouldn't break 100 million domestic. I've never been this wrong in my life.
You were very wrong.
I have an express case of crows and hats being sent to your house right now for dinner.
Appreciate it. For the longest time, Adam's like, there's no way it makes less than 200 million. I'm like, well, there's no way it makes 100 million. We're in a pandemic. Have you paid attention? And he's like, yeah, have you? And he was very, very right.
The time is now.
But even you, nobody forecast this.
Like, not like this.
It's insane. Insane.
You know, I had said to you, I figured this would be the biggest opening of the year. I did not expect the third biggest of all time, but hey, I'm happy for it.
Beat Force Awakens worldwide opening weekend in a pandemic.
And as I said to you the other day, it just goes to show you that even in a pandemic, if people really, really care about something, they will make it happen.
Definitely. I mean, the first thing I noticed was that it beat its own records for mm-hmm. the Spider-Man movies. So in the trilogy, this has been the most successful one. And that to me is just like, wow, people are either really craving Spider-Man MCU films in the theaters, or people are just, they've just been waiting for something big enough that they could go with their friends to see a movie. And this was apparently the one to do that for.
And it beat the other MCU Spider-Man films now by more than double.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's, I think it's so much of what you said, and, you know, people being hungry for top shelf Marvel movies, not that Black Widow or Shang-Chi or the Eternals were not, but I've said this for the past couple years that post Endgame, Marvel has an uphill climb because you're not dealing with this cumulative build towards something. But this is a top shelf property. Spider-Man is, you know, among the most popular characters of all time of anything, merchandising and comics and video games, whatever. He's Spider-Man. That all matters. And as you said, this is the time to fit, I think, quaintly in terms of people going, I want to go back to the movies. This is something I want to go for, you know, maybe before winter gets too crazy. This is the perfect time, because I think if this opened a month from now, I don't think it would be doing these numbers. I think this is the perfect convergence of so many variables to allow for this level of success.
And people are on holiday, people are on break, people are getting, I mean, they're doing things with their families. They've been avoiding them for a long time. Now they're getting together. we have to, it's that time of year. So there's a lot of factors that go into it, but man, I was so ecstatic. And not to mention, I mean, what I think is funny is that the original trilogy, the Tobey Maguire, the best ones, those movies had bigger opening weekends than any of the other Spider-Men, like across the board until this one. And that 1, 2, and 3, I mean, you go look them up. And then you've got, because I think Far From Home was 92 million opening weekend. And then you've got this one, which just blew everything away. And the only thing I can think of is because you brought back the OG, right?
That's all. Yeah, I got there was all the rumors that were floating around that the two were going to return, that they were all going to be here, all the Spider-Men. Yeah.
This is for Toby. We did it for Toby. Give him that Spider-Man score he deserved.
Everyone is so worried as well. I think everyone is so worried about spoilers as well with something like this.
Oh my
God. You know, I'll be very curious to see what our fall off is weekend to weekend because, you know, its front loadedness, I think, will be really, really heavy. You know, everybody who really wanted to see this is going right now because they don't want it ruined for them.
I saw it twice.
I'm ready to see it again. But I think, Adam, that's the other thing is that now that people have seen it and people are loving it, like I've not heard a single bad review of the movie. And so now that people are loving it, they're going to be wanting to go see it again. And so maybe it'll be in a couple weeks or maybe it'll be something after Christmas dies down and they're looking for something to do because they have time off work. I think those initial like 3 weeks, 4 weeks are still going to be pretty good. And then maybe we'll see it die down a little bit after that. But I think we'll start to see.
It'll probably be on pay-per-view by then.
Disney has their way. It will be.
There is no 6 weeks anymore. Yeah.
True.
Man, but I haven't been in a movie where people were clapping, people were screaming, people were cheering.
Like everything. Yes.
Oh, man. The first portal opens. There's a little bit of applause because Garfield's there and they're like, oh, Andrew Garfield. Second portal opens, people lost their shamil.
I lost my shit.
Yeah, it was just crazy. I mean, it was insane. And I was convinced for a little while, I'm like, does he have the teeth? I mean, because I forgot, Toby barely smiles and like his upper lip never goes below his or above his teeth. So I'm just like,
they're very small lips.
It's a weird thing.
Very small lips.
Yeah. Oh, so happy to see him. Well, let's get into the actual discussion of the film. So here's a description of the film, very lightly taken from IMDb. With Spider-Man's identity now revealed, Peter asks Doctor Strange for help. And when a spell goes wrong, dangerous foes from other worlds start to appear, forcing Peter to discover what it truly means to be Spider-Man. Finally, he learns that lesson. Let's talk about the overall plot, Amanda, about Peter wanting the world to forget he's Spider-Man and opening up the multiverse as a result. What did you think of this as the opening of the construct?
Well, first of all, I loved the introduction. And normally, if he was like an older Peter Parker, I would probably say this is so ludicrous that because you didn't get into college and your friends didn't get into college, more so the friends, because he was very selfless in this film, that you're going to, oh, let's just change everything. Let's just go back in time and change all of it. Not for all of the other ramifications to his actual superhero-ness.
Right.
But because he's a young kid, that's where I'm like, okay, he has a little bit more, I don't know, I give some leniency for it because he's so young that I can understand. And when you're that young and you see your friends, their lives are literally being crushed, their dreams, their future and all of that, and you feel that responsibility, that great responsibility on your shoulders, of course you would be doing anything possible to make amends for that and to make things right. And so I was fine with it. I thought it was, you know, sweet, although Doctor Strange, you know, maybe don't say it's okay. You're an adult, man.
And that was one thing I thought as well that was highly, maybe it was more apparent to you, Aaron, the second time you saw it, but I thought Doctor Strange's willingness to go along with something that he immediately prefaced with being so dangerous and so risky, without discussing the plan ahead of time, you know, and basically allowing Peter to dictate the terms of the spell as he was doing it, seemed highly convenient for the sake of the film.
Yes,
but I'll allow it.
Yeah, it was one of those while I'm watching it going, wow, they just said, look, you guys suck it up. It's going to be this way. We don't have time to really make it make complete sense. So we're just going to go ahead and barrel through it. Because if you really think about it, Doctor Strange took about 13 seconds to start the spell. There was no conversation beforehand like, hey, by the way, shut up. You can't say anything while I'm doing this. And are there any parameters you want? Are there certain people that really need to know, you know, any important questions, kind of like interview questions as you were trying for that job? You really need to get that stuff down. And he didn't really preface that. So you really kind of just have to be willing to go along for the ride, which I was. I mean, I feel like some of the stuff they really handled. I was very concerned going into the movie because I only saw the first trailer, and they kind of presented it with Peter Parker wanted the spell done because his name was on there. So you didn't have the selfless aspect. So to me in the trailer, it really came across as Peter Parker is going to get the spell because he's sick of people knowing who he is. And that would have been really selfish to me, which isn't really who I feel Peter Parker is. And thankfully it wasn't that. It was about his friends. And I'm like, okay, that's the character. I mean, took you a few movies to get here, but that's the character. Got it.
You know, and here I'll lean into my comic book historian title a little bit. You know, this plot device is not without precedent. There was a story in 2007 called One More Day, where Spider-Man One More Day, where Peter literally makes a deal with the devil, the non-movie version Mephisto, to basically do the same sort of thing because his identity had been outed during Civil War, and Aunt May had been shot, you know, so it was an effort to try to undo all of that. And, you know, that all, you know, like this does make sense. The to jump from the beginning of the movie to the end of the film, the thing that was very odd, and I know we're allowing the mess up to happen, but sure. To wish that nobody knew he was Spider-Man makes really good logical sense in terms of the plot. But to where we ended, to literally no one even knew Peter Parker existed.
It's a weird turn.
Became a very odd, you know, that was kind of my one big takeaway from the end of the film is I really don't have any idea other than real world licensing issues with Marvel and Sony as a backup, just in case things don't work out, why you would leave yourself in that position, you know, to eliminate the entire supporting cast and essentially any interaction with an Avenger to not know who Peter Parker. It was an odd choice, but we both know in the real world why they did it.
Yeah. I don't know if I like the choice. I mean, I guess you could say they were already breaking through, so they had to take an extreme turn is the way that they painted it at the end. I still think maybe wouldn't that just be solved by forgetting that Peter Parker was Spider-Man? It felt like that would be a quick, easy solution, but forgetting Peter Parker completely just seemed really extreme. But I also feel like, okay, we're going to start anew. We're going to make Peter Parker the character he probably should have been before he was, you know, mini Stark. And this next, wherever it goes next, will be that kind of storyline.
We're back to basics.
Sure.
That's the biggest takeaway I had from it is he's making his own suit. He's doing all of the little things, you know, he's listening to the police whatever it's called, the scanner, so that way he can fight crime. And like that to me is, and I'm not a historian, but to me, that's what I see Spider-Man and Peter Parker as the neighborhood guy, you know, like he's not fighting the world's biggest things and going into space, which was fun and everything, but take him back to the core of who he is and make him the little guy.
Right, because we never got that in the MCU. Right. We left mm-hmm. over that.
Yep, completely, yep. Completely. Which kind of leads me to my next topic, I guess. Well, one of the major issues some have had with these films, and definitely one that I've vocalized, is that Peter seems to always be in the shadow of Tony Stark, and therefore never seems to have his own movie. Because, you know, the Homecoming, he's very much all about wanting to be an Avenger, wanting to be Tony Stark's boy toy, whatever. It's all the fancy suits, it's all the tech gizmos, but yet he's not really making much of them, which is always a bummer if you're a real Spider-Man fan. Yeah, I said real Spider-Man fan. And then the second movie is very much living in the shadow of his death. It's kind of like, you know, Peter Parker dealing with Uncle Ben. Everybody's like, well, Uncle Ben's not part of it. Well, they're trying. They're just making it Uncle Tony. It's weird. But all the villains' motivations from both of those films were Tony Stark related. Like, if you could really go back and watch them, they're directly related to Tony Stark. So this movie, I felt like, well, finally, he gets his own movie. And I feel like finally it felt like Tom Holland has to step into the shoes of Peter Parker / Spider-Man on his own, finally. To me, this is the first real Spider-Man movie of these MCU films.
How did you get it? It feels like he is on his own to carry not only his own character, but also the burden of the decision that he makes within throughout the film. Any number of decisions that he makes are they're all on him.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
as opposed to having an easy out or some safety net where somebody bails him out at the last minute.
Right, right. Because I mean, you look even in Homecoming, like where the you know, the ferry gets, you know, he screws up on the ferry and the ferry gets blown in half.
Mm-hmm.
He's saved by Iron Man. It's a safety net.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't have that here, other than him from another universe.
I mean, Strange kind of saves him with spell to a degree, but he also rectified his problems, but to that point, you know. So, I mean, Spider-Man still did Spider-Man things, and all the Spider-Mans had stuff to actually resolve, as opposed to, well, here's another Stark toy that bailed him out. Here's another Stark convention that saved him, you know.
Yeah, and now, at the very end, he's left without any of that. If nobody remembers he existed, he cannot rely on that. He doesn't even try to rely on the relationship with Happy, which I was a little surprised by, too, because he started to maybe sort of kind of try to work his way in with MJ, but he didn't go to Happy and say, like, look, man, you're not going to believe this, but we know each other, and I was an Avenger. And I think the Tom Holland Spider-Man from two movies ago, or, you know, from the very beginning, he probably would have done that because he was so childish and he was so focused on being one of the Avengers that now he realizes this is not my priority. And that's the part that I really like, is that, you know, he had that moment as a kid. Cool, I get it. You know, if I were 16 years old and Tony Stark came to me and was like, hey, man, you want all of this crazy cool technology and to fight with some of the most awesome and handsomely rugged men and women in the world? I would say, hell yeah, I'm doing that. Well, I, as a female, I'd be excited about that.
Okay, I gotcha.
But he moved past that. And so we see him age up in this story and he becomes, you know, a little wiser, a little smarter. And I really appreciated that the story of Spider-Man was finally about Spider-Man in so many ways. Like, the core of what's going on is him being selfless. It's him. It's so wholesome and pure, which is, I shouldn't leave a Spider-Man movie without feeling like he was wholesome and pure. You know, at some point, I should always feel like he made a really difficult decision, but he did it because he thought it was the best decision possible. And that's what we finally get here, because he's willing to sacrifice everything he knows and loves to save everyone else and to make their lives better.
Including, say, villains, which I thought was, you know, again.
Oh, it was so sweet.
Right. He spent the core plot device of the back half of the film was for him to essentially save all of the villains so that they can go back home and, I guess, not be dead, mm-hmm. you know? You know, again, that's a very selfless thing for Peter to be doing, where in the previous two films, it just felt like it was Peter constantly trying to get himself out of trouble for himself all the time.
Right.
Yeah, I really love that. And speaking of villains, you know, ripping this universe apart leads to many of our favorite villains from literally every Spider-Man movie that we've seen thus far, not including Nicholas Hammond from the TV movies. So, Adam, let's talk about the Sinister. Well, it's really Sinister Five, right?
Yes, five in a touch if we count Venom from the credits.
Five in a touch. So technically, Sinister Six. So Sinister Five. So who is your favorite? And then we'll kind of talk about each one of these guys. We'll talk about them each at a turn.
There is no question that while the marketing led with Alfred Molina's Dr. Octopus, as they say, the real MVP is Willem Dafoe's Norman Osborn / Green Goblin. What they gave him to do in this movie was so much more than I expected, and it just really makes you realize that the guy is the perfect Norman Osborn and perfect Green Goblin. It was so great to see him doing things again in this universe, you know, and not just in a little capacity. He was all over the film, and just, I was so impressed. And it was almost as if, like, Willem Dafoe doesn't look a day older than he did in 2000.
I know, that's
he's like
wild.
66 years old, and I'm like, man, they got some sweet hair dye in this place.
I mean, Alfred Molina, I do know with Alfred Molina, they fixed him up digitally because mm-hmm. he does look quite a bit different. But I don't believe they did that for Willem Dafoe. He just looks exactly the same.
He does. He's got a very, very distinct face.
Yeah.
He does. And you know, he was so great. Like, I don't know about you guys, but I kind of bought in for, like, I knew he was going to turn. I knew that Green Goblin was going to take over again, but I didn't know exactly when. And so when it happened, I was like, oh no, like it did happen. And it took me by surprise because it felt like he was just sweet old Norman. And then Green Goblin takes over and you're like, oh, he's going to destroy everything in his path. Yep. And he sure did. And he was so vicious and like just I can picture Willem Dafoe's face. And I'm just like, so good creepy. God, man, the transition, the talent it takes for without even changing, you know, scenes or anything or shots. We're watching his face turn from this sweet, you know, crumbled, fragile man into this just gruesome villain.
Monster.
And it's so, yeah, a monster. And it's just crazy to watch his talent as you see that change across his face. It's just awesome.
I was extremely impressed with that. And, you know, I love that they brought back the mask because the first movie is one of my favorite movies of all time. I know it looks like a Power Ranger, and it didn't matter because he was able to use his voice behind that mask to really be an extremely wonderful villain in the first Spider-Man movie. No one is going to convince me otherwise. I know the mask looks like shit, and he still delivered. Now you get to see his face, and the whole time you're like, God, why didn't they do that in the first movie, though? That would have been literally a perfect movie.
I saw a fantastic meme not long ago where it said, Willem Dafoe is the perfect Green Goblin. All they did was just Photoshop his face green. And he, you know, because he has the perfect nose and the long chin, he very much looks the character even without a mask.
Yeah, he does. He really does. And did you guys like the I'm something of a scientist line myself?
Fantastic.
Now,
so great.
It is great, but I want to know, do you think it's more because it's become so popular as a meme or just a callback to the first movie?
I think probably both. You know, my son who's 8 has, you know, we just did all the Spider-Man movies, the previous 5, because I knew this was coming.
Very smart on your part, you know, as a parent.
And he was really, he was really into all of them. And so much so that he would, you know, upstairs in our living room, he'll just put on Sam Raimi's first Spider-Man movie, you know, random days, he'll just put it on. And he does it with all of them. And my wife, who had also, you know, kind of watched them with him over this time, even she caught I explained to her, like, hey, did you notice that? That's a meme joke. I said to her, I'm something of a whatever myself. She goes, no, he said that in the first film. And I go, oh, well, all right. You know, so I think it works in both capacities.
Excellent. So how about Doc Ock? We went on to Alfred Molina as Dr. Otto Octavius. I like the bit where they laughed at his name, by the way. That was pretty funny.
It was really nice to give him, you know, like a voice to turn off the monster in Otto, you know, because we only got nice Otto in the film, you know, during that nice dinner scene. Sorry, in Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, it's about 15
during the nice dinner scene where he's talking with Peter and his wife. And, you know, you see that Otto really is a nice guy who wants to help Peter and is impressed by him and is a good person before he's corrupted by his own science. And it was nice to see that Otto come back, you know, rather than dealing with, finger steepling Dr. Octopus over the course of the film.
Right, right.
I thought he was great. And I'll be perfectly honest, I hadn't thought about the Stark technology being able to take over his suit.
Yeah, that
and
was clever.
So yeah. That was a great moment. And I don't know, just to see this vicious, I keep saying vicious, but this really, I don't know, crazy monster get humbled down and incapacitated from being able to do anything was such a fun way to use the technology and to show how smart Peter is. Like, I loved that moment because I was like, oh, what a smart guy. And it really showed him up. They really elevated him in terms of his smarts and his knowledge. And he was a math nerd. They made a joke about him knowing math and everything and geometry. And I'm like, this is great. And Doc Ock was just, everybody in my theater cheered when we saw him come on because it was like, yes. And full disclosure, I had not watched any trailers. I avoided everything. Wow. So I did not.
Did you not know at all?
No.
Oh, wow. That would have been a cool surprise. That would have been so cool.
It was really fun to like see everything. I did get spoiled on Andrew Garfield making an appearance. And so I presumed that Tobey Maguire would be there too. But when they showed up on screen, I still
hang on. We're not there yet. We're on villains still. You hold
that.
I know.
I'm talking about the surprises I had. So yeah, I really enjoyed all of the villains making their appearances and not knowing ahead of time that they were going to be there.
Well, that's a great experience to have.
Oh man,
it was fun.
That would have been great.
I was excited, and I knew everything. It seemed, but it was. I still enjoyed it so much.
I didn't know about the lizard, Adam. Until
sorry about that. I just had assumed you would watch the trailer. You know?
No, I was trying not to. But the lizard was there. I would say probably, I did think the special effects for the lizard were not stellar. But
agreed.
Didn't really detract.
That was the last minute. We'll give that to the fifth VFX house to do.
Exactly. Who's still available? We're kind of busy with all the other stuff. Give it to whoever.
I also thought it was interesting with, you know, with Jamie Foxx's Electro.
They changed him a lot.
Yeah, well, from what I understand, Jamie Foxx said that if he was coming back, he was not going to be blue again. He insisted upon that.
Good. Good
you
call.
Know, but the I thought was interesting is that they used, it seemed in most of the scenes that they used Electro and Jamie Foxx as some method of not just comedy relief, mm-hmm. because, you know, Jamie Foxx has a strong background in comedy, but also as almost like Mr. Exposition. You know, where he was always kind of the guy pushing the narrative because, you know, Otto had become a voice of support and Norman was crazy and the lizard never really said much of anything or was not even in the scene. I'm assuming, again, because of special effects usage.
He was very calculating. He was trying to formulate his plan for escape.
Right. Yeah. You know, so it was funny with Jamie Foxx and Max Dillon. They used him as a... You know, he was the interjector. He was the kind of, well, now what are we going to do about that? And then they would, you know, he would help advance the plot forward. You know, and in a lot of ways, he was such a different character from who he was in Amazing Spider-Man 2. That was the one I think you just kind of had to say, well, I'll accept that it's different just because. You know, because I saw an article yesterday that even mentioned apparently Electro never learns the true identity of Spider-Man in Amazing Spider-Man 2. That's never actually a plot point in the film because he always wants to feel, if you remember, wanted to feel valued by Spider-Man. Max wanted to feel that he was an important person, but never knew that he was Peter Parker. So we'll just assume he found that out after the movie ended, and that's how he came through.
He stayed through the credits somehow.
Yes.
I do feel like they pulled a lot from the PlayStation games, the PS4 games that came out, because a lot of the villains, like Electro, resembled, and then he starts spinning around in the air and everything, too. Mm. So maybe that's where the color change came from, is from the game, from what I can recall of it.
It's the Electro design in Amazing Spider-Man 2 was taken from the Ultimate Universe, the reboot that Marvel did parallel to their main universe, where Peter was an actual high schooler and a kid, and Electro was blue. So that design from Amazing Spider-Man 2, where he was just this mass of electricity, was taken from the Ultimate design rather than the traditional green and yellow hat with the bolts coming off his head and everything, you know.
And even the character Max Dillon is completely different. Like he's more Jamie Foxx than Max Dillon. Max Dillon was very much a nerdy, mousy kind of, even when he got the power.
He was the Riddler in Batman Forever.
Yes, very much so. And here he's just like, I'm going to make this guy cool. I want to be cool. Can I be cool? And they made him cool and I'm okay with it. I'm fine with it.
Yeah, you got to do that, because I saw now that we're post the movie release, you're getting all of the information from the producers and the actors that they had to hold back on. And apparently there was a substantial amount of discussion with the actors who played the villains about what they were going to do, that these were real parts and not just, hey, I'm in one scene and I'm going to fight Spider-Man once.
Right.
You know, that was a big insistence. Like Willem Dafoe said, I'm not coming back if it's a cameo. It ain't happening. And, you know, Jamie Foxx requested not to be blue. You know, so all these things, if you want these people back to tell the story, you got to tell. Sometimes you got to give a little. Because, you know, Marvel doesn't pass out their scripts for screening ahead of time.
No.
So a lot of it is trust.
And we got Thomas Hayden Church back too as Flint Marko and Sandman, who was very empathetic, very, for the most part, was just a guy wanting to get home to his daughter. I like how they played that. Even though he has a lot less to do, I still enjoyed seeing him back because he was the one character in the first trilogy, the villain, that I really kind of felt sorry for.
Yes, and definitely, you know, in a lot of ways, kind of shoehorned in, like many things in Spider-Man 3. You know, he and Venom both felt very shoehorned in to that movie in general. But, you know, I was glad that he was back, and I'm glad they kept that thread going.
Absolutely.
I like the use of his powers because, I don't know, when I think of Sandman, there's different things you can do with it. But for him to help Spider-Man in one part where he's like, oh, I'm gonna trap him in here. And then when he is feeling, you know, I'm feeling a little different about Peter Parker right now. So then he is using it to go against them. And I really liked the way they showed just how powerful that character can be. Because I don't really feel like I've had a good enough understanding of how powerful he could really be. And they showed that.
They did. They did a really, for having, here's my biggest concern walking in, because I knew that I had heard that there were going to be some returning villains, and I knew that there were at least two or three. And all I kept thinking was, oh God, this is going to be like Batman and Robin, or it's going to be like Spider-Man 3, where there was really too many villains. And I'm like, by the time I got to the end of it, because I've always kind of been against the Sinister Six movie, even though I love those characters, because I'm like, I don't think they can write that screenplay. I don't think they can.
On its own, you mean non-hero Sinister
Six
film?
Yeah, I was so concerned that they could do it.
It's an insane idea.
But now I think with this, I think they could maybe pull it off with the right writers. They reinstated my faith.
There's your giant caveat, Aaron, with the right writers, because what you have to realize is the people that are going to be writing the Sinister Six film are not Kevin Feige produced Marvel writers. They're going to be the same people that are bringing you Morbius, the movie.
Oh, I mean, it looks all right. Yeah.
Okay.
It's going to be the Van Helsing crew. Like, they're still waiting for another gig. And they're like, yeah, hey, guys. Exactly. Like, great
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. They're bringing those guys back.
Oh, my God. Don't even start. You know what? There's something we got to announce real quick. You can subscribe on your preferred podcast app to the Hollywood Outsider Presents Bad Movie Night. Each month, another episode from our vault will hit your podcast feed on a film we've discussed. These will always be from our vault, meaning Patreon supporters always get the newest and unedited versions, and they definitely get better as the show goes. So if you want immediate access to the entire library of Bad Movie Night episodes, there's like 50 plus episodes already waiting, and they are unedited on Patreon. Just visit Patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. That's Patreon.com/TheHollywoodOutsider. And sign up for the $3 or better option. You'll gain immediate access to all of them. So that's coming December 20th. If you want to just check it out, The Hollywood Outsider Presents Bad Movie Night. Look for it then. All right. So let's talk about the returning Spider-Man. Oh, so excited. First up, Tobey Maguire. Tell me your thoughts when you first see Tobey Maguire and, you know, his performance here. Like he had a real role.
It was good to see Tobey back again. You know, because I feel like he's an actor who has not done, you know, who doesn't do a lot.
He's semi-retired. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, why not? I mean, you look at the run of films that he had back around Spider-Man, you know, whether it's Spider-Man or Cider House Rules or Wonder Boys, Seabiscuit, you know, a wonderful collection that I think any actor would be proud of being in. I was just really glad that he chose to do this because I think for a lot of years, you know, various interviews I read, in some ways he was completely done with being Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And I got a big laugh out of the part where he said he had a bad back because I know there was, you know, that's
hilarious.
You know, ripped from the headlines, real story, you know, Tobey Maguire's back in Spider-Man. And it was just really good. It was like a warm blanket, you know, because upon my revisiting of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, especially the first one, it is such a romanticized love letter to Spider-Man in so many ways. Mm-hmm. You know, the color palette feels warm. You know, J. Jonah Jameson feels just like this wonderful clown version of J. Jonah Jameson. it's everything that you would want it to be. And for him to come back, it just felt like, hey, you know, a piece of the past came back again, and it all felt all right, you know. And when he talked about how, you know, that he had closure, you know, he got together with Mary Jane, and you know, some things work out, and all that. It was just really great to see a nice bow put on all of that.
It was so wonderful for me, because that's my favorite franchise, is the first trilogy in terms of the Spider-Man films. Like, I love Tobey as Peter. Sure, he wasn't as great with a quip. For whatever reason, to me, he really nailed Peter Parker in a way Tom Holland hasn't come close to until this movie. I'll give him credit in this movie. But very much, like, he's so warm to my heart. Like, and as soon as I see him, I just, my heart palpitates. It's really, like, very personal to me. And what was funny is I saw it twice, and I saw it twice because I missed the moment in the portal. So I literally had to go to the bed, because I thought right after Aunt May's death, I'm like, and then they start, you know, he's very sad. I'm like, oh, this is a perfect moment, because it's going to be like 3 minutes of grief, and I've really got to pee, and I got to get a refill. It only takes a second, and of course, it was so packed, it took way longer than it should have. I came back, and then it's like Tobey and Andrew on the rooftop, and I'm like, "What?
That's
what
just horrible.
Happened?" I was almost in tears in the theater. My wife,
I bet
my wife you chose poorly.
I really did. My wife felt horrible for me, so she just said, "You know what? We're gonna go back. We're gonna go see it again," and so I could get that moment, and I'm glad I did, because it was worth every second of it. And when you get Tobey and you get the closure on MJ and you get the bed back, that was funny. But also, you know, they let him act, which I thought was very, very important. Yep. They let all of these guys act, not just do glorified cameos. And at the end, I'm glad when he stopped Holland from becoming a monster with the glider, you know, he doesn't have a stupid joke or a stupid quip, because that's not who his character was. Like, it was more about heart. And they just did it with a look, with a performance. And I really, really love that they let Tobey Maguire be the Peter Parker I remembered. That was important to me.
Yeah, as soon as he came on screen, I screamed, threw my hands in the air, and I cried. I was already in tears, because I did cry when I saw Garfield. But seeing Tobey come on, I was like, it really, I think Adam said it, it felt like a warm blanket. Like, you just felt like all of my childhood. So I grew up with Tobey Maguire as Spider-Man. You know, that was my first iteration of Spider-Man. And so to see him reprise that role, and to Aaron's point, not have to just, oh, he's here, and, you know, they're just going to support Tom Holland's Spider-Man. He had so much to do, and he had his moments of being funny with the, oh, you're amazing. To,
I like that.
To Andrew Garfield.
It was so meta, but I liked it.
Yes, it was. It was like the meme of where they're all pointing to each other.
Well, they had everything. That moment. They had the pointing. You saw that. They just didn't do it when they're in costume. They did it in the lab. They were pointing to each other while they were like processing.
Oh, I missed that. I'll have to
they're like,
watch
Peter, 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 Peter. And they're all pointing at each other. And it's just like that Spider-Man meme, just not in costume. I love that moment.
That was funny. But he did have so much. He was the core of getting to the heart of who Peter Parker and Spider-Man is. He was the one who was really trying to comfort Tom Holland's Peter Parker when he's distraught, and saying, you know, this happened to my Uncle Ben and it destroyed me. And he shares his story about how it made him become a monster in his own eyes by trying to go and get vengeance, but it did nothing for him. And so when he says that early on, and then he follows it up by, no, I'm not letting you do this to yourself the way I let it destroy me, it's not going to happen. And he prevents Tom Holland from killing him. I just, that whole arc was just so pure to me. And that's what I wanted. That's what I needed. And they gave it to us. And it was more than just nostalgia. It wasn't like, we're just going to bring him back to give it to your feels. Like, he had purpose to the story.
Like, unearned fandom, which is what a lot of nostalgia is. This was very much a very earned performance and role. I mean, it was really. And speaking of earned, I want to segue to Andrew Garfield. How about Andrew Garfield? Because in many ways, I will say, I felt like he kind of got robbed of his third film in many respects. And he was kind of saddled with the problem of the franchise when he was never the problem, in my opinion. I thought he was an excellent, I think he's still the best quippy Spider-Man. Like, his quips are better than anybody else.
Yeah.
He was too cool to be Peter Parker at times. I'm like, Peter Parker's never been that cool, dude. I want to hang out with him. Peter Parker's just not that cool. So, Amanda, what did you think about Andrew Garfield coming back?
Oh, I loved it. And he actually got more closure than I feel most characters did. They all had their own form of closure. But we do get to have him reflect on Gwen, and we do get to have him talk about his feelings and emotions and everything. We get some closure to his movies. But we also get something that I didn't expect, which was Andrew Garfield has just become this insanely talented actor, especially for dramatic scenes.
Yeah.
And so his character here, we really got to test the ranks of what Garfield can do in his role of Peter Parker / Spider-Man. And so that was something I really enjoyed, was he got to be everything. He got to be a little sad. He got to be happy and quippy. He got to be everything. And that's what I really liked about it, is I felt like everyone was given the autonomy to run with their character and to give us more than we expected in every way.
Get those cobwebs.
Oh, that was so cute. He's like, yeah, I guess I'm not gonna crawl. But then, of course, when the grandmother's like, no, can you clean that? And he starts picking up after he makes a mess. I loved it.
You know, we got with Andrew Garfield, in some ways, I feel like the preview of redemption that we'll get with Hayden Christensen in his upcoming Star Wars projects.
Oh,
you know, they're actors that were saddled with the burden of, you know, I guess bad writing, you know, an unfortunate circumstance in pop culture at the time, you know, where, you know, the two amazing movies are just so, they're just so odd in terms of them being Spider-Man, where they got a lot of the Spider-Man stuff right, but they got the Peter stuff wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The movies are set like so much of the Spider-Man sequences are all at night. You know, so it's a much, they're just darker films. The parent stuff is baffling.
Dumb. The parent stuff is dumb.
Just, you know, the bedridden Norman Osborn thing is just, it's all just very weird. And by the end of Amazing Spider-Man 2, you know, I was interested to see what exactly was going to happen in the next film. But both of those movies, I left with the feeling of going, well, if they can do more of what's good and less of what's bad, you know, they'll be in an all right place.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave Andrew Garfield the chance to atone for other people's sins.
Oh, and when he saves her.
That. That's a good way to say it.
Yeah, you know, and they gave him a chance in this movie to right the ship, to make everything that he did worth something, and to have those movies have weight beyond where we were cut off from watching them, you know, to know that he was haunted by his ability to not her, sorry, his inability to not save Gwen. And, you know, and like he mentioned, you know, the punches just started getting harder. You know, he became a, you know, a dark Spider-Man in some ways. And it was nice to see all of that kind of wrapped up and brought back. And, you know, I don't have a bad word to say about Andrew Garfield. I think he's great. I never thought he was a bad actor in those movies, because clearly the script was a much larger problem than his ability. And, again, just really great to see it all brought back together. And this will give Andrew Garfield in those movies more credence than they could have ever earned on their own.
I agree.
Right.
I agree.
You know, it in a lot of ways, like I said, it's like the rehab work that Star Wars has done on the prequels. There's people that look back and go, yeah, you know, they were all right. I mean, there was parts that didn't work, but, you know, I think I really still like them. And that was not the case for what? 10 years, 15 years, the prequels were the worst thing ever for Star Wars.
And they probably still aren't great.
What's that?
They probably still aren't great, but...
Yeah, but they're leagues better than our modern trilogy, but we won't get into that today.
Oh, boy, Adam.
That's funny. Yeah, it was wonderful to see both Toby, because they originally were going to do Spider-Man 4, and that fell apart, and that's how Amazing came across. So it was great that he got his final say to like explain where they were going. And then Garfield got his wherever Amazing Spider-Man 3 was going to go. I love that Toby called him amazing. Like that was, you know, I'm laughing so hard at that joke. Nobody else around me is. I'm like, nobody else knows they were called Amazing Spider-Man.
You don't get that
seriously?
Joke.
I thought I was alone. All right. So that's the two returning. Now we've got Tom Holland. I will say Tom Holland for me has always been, he started off very, very whiny in Homecoming. And he's gotten better every movie. Where do you land on Tom Holland, Adam, now that he's finally got a full slate.
You know, just like with Andrew Garfield, I've never had any issue with the decisions that Tom Holland has made as an actor. I really loved the very young Peter Parker, because even Garfield's amazing films, you know, he looked like he was in his early 20s. And even the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies, it was like Beverly Hills 90210. You know, these were all adults in this high school, in that school. So I always liked the young, kind of, I guess, messy, inexperienced, sloppy Spider-Man. But I never had any issue with the decisions that Tom Holland made. I always thought he was a competent actor. You know, his blipping scene in Infinity War is all the feels.
It hits.
You know, and I just think the devastation that he had both at the end of No Way Home, you know, how beat up he was dealing with Mysterio and how just completely like hurt he was, you know, during that fight, which conveniently he was not at the beginning of this movie, go figure. but the damage that he took in this film physically and emotionally, you really felt for his performance, you know, that he was just, you know, in Aunt May's death scene, where he's just so, you know, after being powerbombed through floors of a building, you can just see how beat up he is and how, you know, how being Spider-Man is such hard work on days like this. You know, it gave him a real opportunity to grow up as a character. So I look forward to where he goes with the character. I'm happy that he's Spider-Man because he feels right to me. You know, it's not somebody that I'm going, yeah, but if they can get somebody who's a little whatever, I'm happy with him. He's all right.
Yeah, they really developed him in ways that I was not expecting whatsoever. I was really hoping that this day would finally come, and it did, because like Aaron said, he was just a child, and they played him so childish. That's what they wanted from him. And it was all to do with his relationship with Tony Stark and, you know, trying to be the next Avenger or whatever. But here we finally, things are put into perspective for him when he experiences loss, when he experiences failure, you know, trying to save people and realizing that some people don't want to be saved and it's hard to do that. And seeing the impact on him, you know, like he doesn't give up, he continues fighting, but it took a toll on him. And then from the point where you see him lose May on, I mean, my God, every scene that he was on, I couldn't help but weep for him because he made me feel so empathetic. And I felt at the very end, especially when he goes to see MJ a couple times, you know, a couple movies ago, he would have been still that childish kid who was like, I gotta tell you, Ned, oh my God, I gotta tell you all of this. And instead he's just like, he's tearing up, he's crying, he's holding himself back, and he's like, there's a better way to do this. And I need to know that she's okay, that things are okay, that I made the right decision. And he's fine with that. And he starts to continue moving on with his life. And for me, that was the biggest thing, is can you really take him and transform him from someone who focused on himself in so many ways, in almost a disgusting amount, to someone who naturally is selfless, is always doing everything to benefit others at the expense of himself. And when he's crying, when he's looking at MJ, I was just like, this is Peter Parker, man. Like, I'm here for it.
Yeah, it took me a while to get there, or it took them a while. It took them 5 movies to do what the other movies did in a half of one, but they got there, and that's what matters. And I do think this movie proved to me that Adam, you're not in this movie.
I was not in it, no.
No. It proves to me that Tom Holland definitely has more acting chops than I might have given him credit for, because the last half of the movie, I mean, it's basically just like a grief bomb for him. And he straddles the line. He still goes back and forth, like he still has some fun with his friends and makes some jokes and some wisecracks and stuff. But when it's dramatic, he carries the weight, and that's very important. So I love that.
Oh, one thing I was going to say too, the beautiful writing of it, where we get in the beginning, and this is the development of his character. The beginning, he's willing to ask Doctor Strange to make all of the changes, like, oh, don't forget this person. No, don't forget that person.
That was cute, yeah.
But he loses Aunt May, which has literally crumbled him inside.
Mm-hmm.
And when the opportunity, when things are starting to really just break down and he has to make a decision, he didn't say, can we also make it so Aunt May is not dead?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't do that. And to me, that is just...
He learned.
You see so much growth. Yes, he did learn. And he saw so much growth in just that 2.5 hours or whatever. And that was a great thing to see.
It was. Well, before we go to Aunt May, I want to any supporting cast mentions? I mean, you've got a lot of supporting members. You got Flash, you got Ned, you got Zendaya, obviously, as MJ. Any of those like really stood out? Obviously, I will say the relationship between MJ and Peter was really sweet this go round. But who stood out to mm-hmm. you?
I mean, I was kind of taken aback, you know, upon my reflection afterwards by how, in a lot of ways, how little most of these people were in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at No Way Homecoming and No Way Home, those are really,
Far From Home.
Far From Home and
Homecoming,
you Far From Home and Homecoming, yes. Those were high school movies. You know, those were movies with ensemble right. casts and mm-hmm. Flash and friends and teachers and classmates and all that stuff. And this really, they were there for, you know, for a cup of coffee over the course of the film. You know, Flash had his couple of scenes, which were, you know, I think those were funny. But on a whole, most of what made those previous two movies kind of like modern John Hughes
yeah.
high school superhero movies, all that was gone. You know, and I think that was a lot of that was probably sacrificed at the point when they turned this into the multiverse Spider-Man, the live action multiverse film versus the Kraven the Hunter sequel to Far From Home, you know, right. that was abandoned for this. So I think, unfortunately, that was probably the thing we lost was all of those great characters and actors over the course of the film.
There were two people that gave me a good laugh. Paula Newsome as the MIT leader who after Doc Ock, you know, basically almost kills her, and she gets out of the car scold and she's him. Like, oh, no, I got to tell him.
Yeah.
That was not okay.
That was
I loved that moment from her. And she also was so sweet when, you know, how it was written and Tom Holland's like, oh, just my friends. And she's like, no, kid, like also you're a hero. And that was a sweet, beautiful moment. And then also Hannibal Buress, because he's the conspiracy theorist and he's like, so ridiculous. Oh, no, Mysterio was right.
You murdered them. We know what you did. Mm-hmm.
And also, too, I don't think we should move on, because in a lot of ways, in my mind, I take it as a given, but can we also put a giant plug in for J.K. Simmons? The wonderful J. Jonah Jameson, even though, you know, he's Alex Jones, J. Jonah Jameson now, even complete with the supplement plug.
Oh, absolutely.
It was just great to have him back again, because that's just such an iconic performance. Even if it's a slightly different version of the character, I can't believe we missed him for so long.
I was so happy that he was back. And he's part of this universe, too. So
yeah, so he's here to stay.
Yeah, he's part of this universe. And also Benedict Cumberbatch, Doctor Strange. You know, I'm not a huge Doctor Strange fan. I really don't care that much about magic. It's just not my thing. But I like how he was used here and actually had some good jokes, some good retorts. I was kind of impressed with that. So
he's in my issues column.
Oh, well, hold tight.
Yeah, we can talk about that.
Hey,
well, I was going to say, too, I do want to mention, because Ned has been a character that I felt has been completely useless for most of these movies. You know, he's just there to be the friend or whatever mm-hmm. and to give us some comedic relief.
He's the guy in the chair. Come on.
Yep.
Yes. Here, he did a little bit more, which was nice, and he was still a kid trying to learn his way, but I loved the whole, you know, they say there's magic in our family. And when Doctor Strange was like, you opened a portal, and it was like, whoa, this isn't, not everybody can do that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was great. And I love that they finally gave Ned something to do throughout the movie.
Happy Jon Favreau returns. He has stuff to do. It was good to see him.
Oh my God. His breakup with May.
So funny. It's really a boundaries issue. That was really
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I do want to mention, because we haven't mentioned this, Charlie Cox returning as Daredevil / Matt Murdock. Well, actually, just Matt Murdock. But, and he's part of this freaking universe, even
it's
though
pointless.
Kevin Feige likes to say that they're not part of this. Shut up, Feige. He's part of this universe. They are.
We will really, as I said to you,
yeah.
And we'll find out, hope, you know, potentially next week on Hawkeye as well. We are still, the jury is still out on how heavily they're leaning into that. If this is a soft reboot of Daredevil and Kingpin both, or if they're going to, I mean, not that they probably have to do a lot to invalidate or to validate the
showing
original
up
series.
Invalidated. Come on.
Oh, no, I understand that. But I mean, I don't think there's a lot of writing except for in future Daredevil projects that would necessarily contradict what had already gone by.
Sure.
You know, so at this point, yes, we'll say they're the same people until we get a Daredevil film with him meeting Karen Page for the first time. then it's all out the window.
It would be so weird if they had different supporting characters. I mean,
because they were so great too. So yeah. I don't want to get rid of any of them.
Did you guys feel like it was a waste of time to have him there though? Because nothing happened with it.
Well, if I think, again, as I mentioned with the supporting cast, I think probably the Spider-Man legal troubles thing was probably in the bones of whatever Spider-Man 3 was going to be before the multiverse stuff. Because when you left that last film, you go, oh man, Spider-Man's going to need a lawyer.
Yeah, he's screwed.
And there's only one lawyer you're going to call, you know, and that has always been my very natural inclination of, well, you have to have Daredevil be his lawyer. That's got to be.
Maybe he gets his own movie now. You never know.
Yeah.
It was fun seeing him use his powers, though, because he's like, how did you do that? When the rock comes through the window
lawyer.
And he's like, I'm a very good lawyer.
It was funny.
I was just glad it was there.
All right. Now let's talk about Marissa Tomei and Aunt May's death. And finally, the introduction of with great power comes great responsibility. If you don't know how important that is, it is literally the bedrock for Peter Parker. It's kind of what his whole mission is. It's centered around is when his Uncle Ben died. That's what he told him. And that's how he went out and pursued his life. Like, that's how he saved people. He's like, I have this great power and I have to be responsible with it. I cannot waste it. I cannot use it for bad things. Like, I have to use it for good. So in terms of, does this solve my Uncle Ben problem, which has been that they never even mentioned Uncle Ben? Yes and no. I do wish they would have acknowledged the dead uncle at some point.
How about a gravestone at the end?
Yes, something.
That seems so natural to me.
Easy
I thought
out
when
too.
He was sad and he went to the rooftop that he was going to be going to Uncle Ben's grave. And that was going to be our moment where it was like, he never talks about it with anyone because he's so distraught by losing Uncle Ben that's the one
and
place
now it's
he
worse.
Would go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, some people have said that Uncle Tony was Uncle Ben. I'm like, not really. That never had the same kind of impact because Tony Stark is just not the same kind of character. Like, he didn't have that morality. But May does, obviously. And they do try to kind of use that to correlate to Uncle Ben very much. I mean, they're very much saying Aunt May is basically the Uncle Ben death is what they're alluding to. And I think that's fine. I mean, it's not what I want. But it's also alternate universe, blah, 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 blah. You can find loopholes in it. And it was very impactful, so it definitely worked. But once that line came out, I'm like, well, she's dead.
It was so sad. I was sobbing. I was crying so hard. And she just kept saying, I'm tired. I'm like, no, she's going to die. But when he goes and he tries to, he leaps up to get the bomb to protect her. I was, oh my God, my heart just broke because I'm like, this is Spider-Man. Mm. This is what he would do. And then he doesn't leave her side. And part of me was like, maybe you should yell a little bit louder, like
get
swing
her to
her
a
out
hospital,
or something.
Man.
Yeah. Like, I think there's an ambulance
he
out
yelled
there.
Yelled once for an ambulance. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I
and
think
then the cops shot him.
Yeah.
Yeah. If he walked out, that there's a potential that would happen. And he may have also been just so stricken with grief because it's not like, in the original, I shouldn't say the original, but the first Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire, it's not like he picked him up and was like, oh, let me get you to the hospital so you don't die. Mm-hmm. So it's just a common thing where he's just so stricken with that grief. He doesn't know what to do. And he did try yelling, but he just didn't want to leave her side. And I thought that was very sweet and special. And Tomei was just magnificent in all of this.
Adam, you have any thoughts on Aunt May? Or?
Not really. I'm glad it happened.
Do you feel like Tomei was wasted for the other movies?
Because a little bit because she was used as a lot of comedy more than hot aunt. More than anything else. There was never really that. You know, she was never at risk previously. Like, mm-hmm. I can't remember the actress in the original Spider-Man trilogy. She was at risk at several times. You know, where she hit Dr. Octopus in the head with the umbrella there. You know, she was involved in those things where Marissa Tomei really was not. She was just kind of there in passing for most of the films. But now, you know, one of Aaron's previous points is now we have Spider-Man kind of where he needs to be, where he has a true motivation for being who he is, mm-hmm. and he has that grief in the past, not just for Tony, but now for his family as well. Mm-hmm. And what I'm kind of curious to see, because, you know, in Spider-Man lore, you know, it is Uncle Ben's death that solidifies Peter as Spider-Man, mm-hmm. right? But now that we now, in the modern MCU, we don't know what, you know, Peter's early days as Spider-Man. I'm kind of curious to see what they do with the animated series that's coming out. You know, Spider-Man freshman year, to kind of see what are, well, maybe we'll see Peter actually get bit by a spider in the context of this universe and see how all that happened and, you know, those earliest days, because I think that's a piece of the character that is, wasn't necessary at the time when they brought him in to the MCU, mm-hmm. but I think maybe is necessary now for the larger context of this version of the character that we're going to have for a while.
Since you changed it.
Yeah. Right.
We should also not forget to mention the web shooter. They talk about it where... Well,
hang on,
you know,
real quick. I want to mention it. It's Rosemary Harris, just so you know. That's who...
Oh, thank you.
That was Aunt May in the original series. And she had a beautiful hero speech that Tomei never got, but whatever.
You're not Superman, you know.
Go ahead, Amanda. Sorry. The web shooters, yes. How do you do that?
Yes.
In your body.
Yeah, that I thought that was great because it shows you the differences for people who maybe don't know, who are just watching the movies, for them to understand that, you know, it depends on which way you're going. You know, some of the films, they have it just part of his body. And then there was the fun joke about, does it come out of any other parts
of your
body?
Does it only come out of your wrist?
Yeah.
I love that they asked that because everybody is always... made that joke, like, where does it come out everywhere else? Like, I was so happy they made that joke. I thought that was great.
Yeah, that was great.
Because it is such an odd thing.
It's so weird. You and I probably both hated it when it came out, right? Because we were such Spider-Man fans. We're like, what are you doing? But it actually kind of worked when it came out.
Yeah, it was just kind of weird, you know? Yeah. But Sam Raimi has horror background and, you know, body horror is a whole genre of horror.
Right.
So, I mean, that does kind of lean into that a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Explains why he got all, you know, web blocked. That's what they called it, web blocked.
Yeah, he was blocked.
Yeah. All right. So, issues with the movie we haven't already talked about. Adam, you said you got an issues list. Now I'm curious. What?
My issue is just kind of one giant issue.
Okay.
I really don't like Doctor Strange with so much levity.
Too light, too.
Yeah, I think if you look at the original Scott Derrickson Doctor Strange film, mm-hmm. you can clearly see Strange is a serious character who is, you know, who's a real jerk, and you can almost see the seams in the film where they dropped in the little jokes about the Wi-Fi and the funny scene in the library where he's grabbing books out of the portals and stuff. Like, the levity they inserted into a film that was a serious Doctor Strange film. And in some ways, I think that's kind of why Scott Derrickson and Marvel parted ways on the next Doctor Strange film, because he, I think, wanted to make a different film for whatever reason, mm-hmm. right? But this whole Doctor Strange, you know, being flippant with his power, you know,
that was
Wong,
a surprise.
Wong being Sorcerer Supreme because Doctor Strange was blipped. I'm fine with that. But for Steven to be so flippant with his magic, his willingness to do an extremely dangerous spell with seemingly no forethought at all, him bringing Peter into the mirror universe and having essentially a one-on-one fight with Spider-Man, and to have him be so easily dispatched by Spider-Man was baffling to me for the character of Doctor Strange. It was very weird. I just don't understand it. The comic book nerd in me, there's no fight that Spider-Man would beat Doctor Strange in that involved magic. There is no, that's just not possible.
Especially in the multi,
the mirror, right?
Yeah, the mirror. The mirror,
just very weird. You know, when he tied him up and he goes, oh, yay, geometry, math is better, and just jumps through the portal and leaves him there. I said, really?
Yeah.
All right. You know, and my second primary issue as an adjacency to that is Ned Leeds, Sorcerer Supreme, just was so, again, so callous, I thought. You just pick up Doctor Strange's sling rings and you're opening up portals like nobody's business. You saw the toil that Steven and the other sorcerers at that training camp went through in the original Doctor Strange movie just to open a portal, let alone multiple, and to do it over and over again and with to do no it ex- prior
pinpoint precision too. Pinpoint
right.
precision.
It just yeah. it kind of the nerd in me was very bothered by that. I know it works for the general audiences and nobody cares and you can write it off with, oh, I have magic in my background. Well, fantastic. Okay. But I just thought that was kind of fast and loose with something that is treated so seriously in WandaVision, in what will be the next Doctor Strange film, in What If, to just be thrown around flippantly just seemed odd to me.
Yeah, no, I do agree. Like I said, I like that they gave Ned something to do, but in much of the magic of this movie, it is just tossed around and it is just like, oh, anybody can do it. And it's fine. You know, let's just try it out a little bit. And at this point, WandaVision would have happened, right? And so Doctor Strange just being so lenient about trying things that could be
undo
so
all of time and space, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, literally.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, that was the part that I struggled with, especially in the beginning where, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch is great. I have no complaints about him. But Doctor Strange, it was just a little too strange, you know, that he was fine with all of it, especially when Juan is like, no, man, like, leave me out of it. And he's like, all right, see you later. Well, I'll talk to you later and tell you how it all goes.
We'll do it when he leaves. It's fine.
Yeah. It's bizarre. It's very bizarre for a wizard who has so much foreknowledge. You know, he can see things that are coming from the future. So how does he not see, damage?
When you look at the character around this particular film, either in his own movie, in the Avengers films, in What If, and what presumably is his next film, it's almost like it's a different person.
I agree with that.
You know? Yeah. And it was like that way kind of in the Thor movie too. You know, you got comedy Doctor Strange for that brief scene there too, which is okay, but just, you know, the magic just seemed too callous to me.
Very much. I would agree with that 100%. Like a big problem I have, even though everybody loves Thor Ragnarok, I'm like, but you just made him an idiot. Like he's just a dimbulb for most of the movies now, but people love that. So they're riding it. Even though I liked Strange in this, it's because I don't like Doctor Strange in the typical movie. Like it's not my kind of character. I don't really dig in magic and stuff. You know, I want real world stuff that I say that. And then I'm for a guy.
Real world, like people climbing walls. I get it.
Yeah. So, but I was kind of happy to have that. But I agree with you. But I do have an issue with the overall story. The story is ridiculous. If you really stop for 5 seconds to think about it, the whole idea is ridiculous. It is. And that's taking into account, it's a comic book world and da 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 da. And I can swallow all that stuff. But then there's just so many things like, why wouldn't Doctor Strange say, is there anybody you want to remember, kid? At the very end, why wouldn't Doctor Strange make sure he remembered? Like, there's just certain little things that don't make sense if you really stop for 5 seconds to think about it.
It's the thing that's the piece of this movie that we'll have to wait for 5 years
to
really be able to look back on it and say, well, did that work? Was that ridiculous? Because right now, clearly, we're very swept up in
the
experience and the emotion and all of that. And we'll have to see how this movie settles out over the long term.
The other thing is after he actually does the spell and Peter's like, wait, I could have called them. And he's like, you didn't call them? You didn't think to ask him? Did you? Here, kid, let me, since I have this knowledge, let me give you a little bit. Why don't you talk to the college? Why don't you try and do this? Have you tried to do that? Like, he didn't ask any questions. He was just like, well, since you insist, mm-hmm. Brevity. I suppose. Brevity.
Yep, exactly. It was crazy. Crazy. Mm-hmm. My other issue is Sandman, I think, looked better in Spider-Man 3. Than it does here. Now, you just watched him, Adam. How do you feel? I mean,
I think honestly, it was the amount of time they had him as a like the walking sand creature in the apartment. Like when he sat down and got sand all over the couch mm-hmm. and stuff. Like I was even doubting at that point whether or not that was even Thomas Hayden Church or not.
I was too. Yeah, I was too.
You know, because I said, oh, did they just get another guy? And that's why he's not a human. He's the sand, so that we can kind of. Mm-hmm. Not be Thomas Hayden Church. But I think it was probably just a I guess, comedic decision to have him walk around as sand instead of as Flint Marko with the green shirt.
But you know, I thought the Sandman looked like the effects for that looked better.
I mean, I think the big scale effects, like when he was the big fist or mm-hmm. the cloud, like all that looked fine for me. It was the close-up facial stuff.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Of the sand. Better. Well, the same problem with the lizard. I mean, there was one point where the lizard was talking in shadows where his mouth, see, I'm doing this on video so the listeners can't really see this, but his mouth almost had a block over it of like it looked like on Conan, like where they used to put the lips over the still photos. Yes. It looked almost like that where there was this mouth talking over a still photo of the lizard. You know, but that's when, you know, I'm sure COVID, I'm sure scheduling, all those things. Sometimes some things you got to rush.
Absolutely. All right. We're almost done. Favorite moments that we haven't already talked. We've talked about a ton of them. But is there any favorite moment we haven't already mentioned, Amanda?
I feel like I have to mention, and I maybe I'm stealing this from Adam as a very large Star Wars nerd, but the Palpatine Lego creature was so cute. I thought that was such a fun tie-in. I don't know, like, in terms of, I guess Star Wars exists in their reality, which is kind of interesting, but I thought that was cute.
It was good to see that brought back, because if you remember, it was in the very first one in Homecoming, you know, the day Ned finds out Peter is Spider-Man, is he went to his apartment to help him build the Lego Death Star.
Yeah.
Oh, you know? I didn't even remember that.
And, you know, and of course, Ned drops it in that film when he sees that Peter is Spider-Man. And then in this mm-hmm. one, I think Stark's robot knocks over the Death Star, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Someone else breaks the Death Star in this one. but yes, that was great to see the Legos back again.
I love the hero moment, you know, when you have all three of them together. Is that stealing from you, Adam?
I mean, I just thought of my most favorite. You go first. Sorry.
Okay. Well, it's a hero moment, and you know, like I said, I haven't seen a reaction since Endgame for a movie like this. And yes, they cheered for Toby. They cheered for Andrew. But that hero shot where there's all three swinging together, and they're coming, and the moon's behind them, and my whole theater was exploding, just exploding, and it was so cool because, you know, they're. I saw it twice. The first time I saw it was the Thursday night preview, which is the diehard fans, right? And they clapped and cheered at all the stuff too. But then I went and saw it in the afternoon, and it was all mostly families. And to see little kids cheering for Tobey Maguire was cool because that was exciting. Seeing the same little kid, like a lot of them cheering for Andrew Garfield too. But that hero moment hits, and then like the whole theater lost their minds. It was an Endgame type experience, and I'm like. I haven't had this in so long. It reminded me why movie theaters mean so much to me. And I'm like, yes, that was
agreed.
Just ecstatic. I was ecstatic.
My favorite moment that has not been mentioned is several. Hooray for musical continuity. I was so, so glad to hear them bring back Danny Elfman's Spider-Man theme.
Yep.
The Green Goblin theme, the Dr. Octopus theme. I was glad they brought back James Newton Howard's music. For the amazing films. I love that. I think that for me, as a film music nerd, that is so, so important to me. And I hate that Iron Man has three different themes in the MCU. I hate that Thor has three different themes. I hate that we only got to hear the first Avenger theme a handful of times after that film. Mm-hmm. That's so important. And it was there. If you listened, it was just brings the film score nerd, warms the cockles of my heart.
Oh, so it was so sweet. And each hero had their hero moment. I mean, it was very well orchestrated, and God, love them. Oh, and another favorite moment, because when Toby gets, when Tom Holland, Spider-Man 1, when he does get the glider and he's almost going to kill him, and Toby saves him, and then he's stabbed. I was convinced he wasn't going to die, so that really didn't bother me. But then
I'm sorry, go ahead, Peter.
Well, no, then Andrew threw the antidote for Green Goblin, and he caught, and Tom Holland catches it and puts it in his neck.
Oh,
and
that was cool.
Because I was really mad for a second, because I'm like, Toby, you just took, like, Peter Parker needs to make that decision himself to not kill him. Like, it was always his thing. Like, he was never a murderer, but he didn't have to save the guy that he let die. And there's a big difference there in terms of, I'm going to just take this glider and shove it on your face. And he did choose to do the right thing in the second chance he had. And I thought that was important, very, very important to me loving that character.
I think it was important for him, and the decision he did it is because once he was taken out of his rage, he didn't want May's death to be in vain. Because realistically, had she not been running away with the antidotes, she wouldn't have been caught up in all of this, more than likely. And so that bag, and I think they did like a moment where they look at the antidote or whatever at some point through all of the fighting. And it's just like, he had to do it. You know, everything he was doing from that point was for May. Even the bad and the good was for May and in her name. And so him doing it was like, I'm not going to kill him, but I'm going to make sure that her death was worth it, that it was for something good.
To your point, Aaron, about the moment when Toby was stabbed, don't tell me they didn't shoot a version where he died.
Oh, you think so?
It just looks, it was such an obvious, it was such an obvious death scene. And then to have it quickly go, oh yeah, I've been stabbed before, I'm good. I was like, okay, that was we can't fit in Toby's death here and maybe it's not necessary, so we're going to just forego it. But it just seemed very natural to me at that moment.
You would have lost me if they killed Tobey Maguire.
Especially with all the closure. Well, that's probably why. I'm sure some test audience somewhere said, no, we don't like that, so they took it out, you know?
Yeah, I would have grabbed a picket sign or something. I mean, there's no way.
I would have walked out of the theater. Honestly, if they would have killed him in that moment, because...
I wouldn't have done that. I mean, I paid $10 a ticket. I'm not
walking.
Right, and you got to at least get all 10 out of it, right?
I'm getting all 10 of it, and I'm just going to complain through all the credits. And then I'll make a TikTok video where I complain. Then it'll go viral and it'll destroy Disney. That's the plan.
Sony.
Or Sony. Either one.
Right.
Either one.
Can we destroy Sony at this point, please?
No. I don't want Spider-Man to ever go all the way to Disney. I don't. And I know I'm the only one that feels that way, and I don't care.
You are the only one.
I want some separation, man. I want some separation. You'd never get a Venom movie, and I like the Venom movies.
Oh, please. Can we segue to the
next topic, please? Please, have at it.
Oh, boy.
Have it. How do you like the tease that, in case people are unclear, in the Venom movie, it's teased that, hey, Venom's in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And then this movie tells you, not really. Ah, sucker. How'd you feel about that?
It just doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand why Sony doesn't want some of the big dollars instead of all of the small dollars. Okay. So now we have the Venom symbiote in the main Marvel Cinematic Universe with a Peter Parker that no one knows exists and a Spider-Man and that no one knows who he is. And we have a Venom in a separate universe with no Spider-Man and no heroes. And it's just such a mess. I don't understand what point it serves at this point.
It's got to be like the deal, right? They made the deal.
Of course it is. 100%.
It's got to be where Marvel Cinematic Universe said, look, Tom Hardy is not going to be in our universe. We're not going to let your Venom, your Morbius, it can't be in our universe. But you can do your own. Maybe Andrew Garfield can pop up in that universe as Spider-Man or something.
Or another Spider-Man.
True. You know, I wouldn't want that. But
I don't know. I wouldn't want that either. But look, Sony is crazy. You don't know. I mean, the projects that these people are developing that they think are a good idea doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah,
we do not need a Morbius the Living Vampire movie. We do not need a Silver Sable movie. We did not need an Aunt May movie. Remember, they were talking about that for a little while. It's insane. You cannot have the rights to Spider-Man to tell Spider-Man stories and never have Spider-Man in it.
Now they could do an Aunt May movie, just be like Weekend at Bernie style.
And it'd
be like,
right? Aunt May. Yeah. Oh, that would be, yeah, that's the win. But yeah,
it's. Or just, they do one where she had Uncle Ben and then they confirmed that there was Uncle Ben. And
she killed,
Uncle Ben.
It's a true crime.
Yeah.
I like it.
But yeah, so the Venom thing, like, I guess I was glad it was there, but like, it served no purpose other than now depositing a piece of Venom to infect our universe's Eddie Brock at some point.
Which, I thought it was so weird because you made so many fans, you know, people are just like going ecstatic over this scene. And I'm just like, you realize it's kind of a slap to the face of Venom fans, right? I mean, it really is because it's saying.
Because Venom clearly makes money.
Yeah. It's obviously hit people like Venom. Wouldn't you want to see this Venom with Tom Holland? People have been wanting that for a while and you're not going to get it. So yeah, it's, I don't get it. It's a weird choice. It's a weird choice.
Baffling.
It just felt like it was, okay, we're going to lead you one direction with the Venom movie. And then MCU's like, well, maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah,
and, let's not get ahead of ourselves here, Sony.
And again, I think we're still left with a Spider-Man, a universe, the Sony-verse, all these things, I feel like are just left super ambiguous in case all this falls apart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because, both Amy Pascal and Kevin Feige seem adamant that they do not want this to end up with that situation we had after the second film, where the deal was over and Sony was walking away, maybe. I think they do want to continue it, but all of these things are just backups in case, because if you notice, we now have a Spider-Man character set up that requires no supporting cast, no mention of the Avengers. The world doesn't know who he is. Sony could take him back and do whatever they want at this point, and none of this would matter because nobody remembers. You know, it's like intellectual property insurance, which is unfortunately a disservice to the story.
Yeah. I don't like putting in a stinger that just leaves us with uncertainty. That's the thing that's like, what was the point of this? It feels like you just wasted my time.
One led you to think you were getting a Venom versus Spider-Man movie, and then the other one to remind you, not really, haha, suckas.
Right. We just took Venom out of Sony's verse is all they did.
Yeah, that's all they did. That's all they did.
Which I'm fine with.
Now, Amanda, we do have we didn't get an after credit scene, but it was a trailer for Doctor Strange, which I'm sure Marvel's like, we'll do this movie, but we're going to promote our movie. But also has a little Scarlet Witch in it. So what did you think of Doctor Strange and the, what was the full title?
In the Multiverse of Madness?
Yes, there you go. So what'd you think?
Oh, man. I mean, of course, for me, as a Scarlet Witch lover and Wanda lover, it was great to see her back on and to see them coming to her. And she's obviously recovered from her dark days in WandaVision. And, you know, for those who didn't watch it, you're screwed. You're going to have to watch it, I feel like, because they are alluding to, I mean, they said it before, but now it's confirmed. Like, this is all very connected. You have to watch the shows to be able to truly understand some of the context of the movies.
I mean, they mentioned.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. I think it looks good. I think it looks interesting. I'll be perfectly honest. If Scarlet Witch wasn't in it, I don't know that I'd care to watch it that much, but I'll watch it because she's in it. So,
Adam, do you feel like it looks more like what you want Doctor Strange to look like?
Yes. Yes. I mean, this is going to be with Sam Raimi directing, it's definitely going to be a horror movie, I was glad to see Chiwetel Ejiofor back as Mordo. I was glad to see him back with his long hair now.
Yep.
But the thing that I lost my mind the most for is forget about Scarlet Witch, forget about Westview. I was excited to see evil Doctor Strange.
Yeah.
At the very end of the trailer.
Yeah.
Because now even the cartoons matter that they're doing on Disney Plus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
what's
what's
different about that character? Because I didn't watch What If. So
you should. It was really a great experiment that did much more than I thought it would originally. You know, What If as a comic, you know, What If was always these one issue hypotheticals of what if somebody didn't die? What if so and so took the Infinity Gauntlet instead? You know, anything like that. And they just tell a little wacky one issue story. the television, the animated series ended up taking six or seven of those, what's seemingly anthology-based standalone mm-hmm. stories, and making it something that was a connected multiverse yeah. thing. And one of the episodes was dealt with, you know, Doctor Strange, and I can't remember what the title of the episode was at this point, but basically it was like Groundhog Day, where he was trying to save Rachel McAdams from dying and he kept going over and over and over again, and in his efforts to try to get enough magic to stop this event from happening, he ends up going mad basically over the course of the episode. So by the end, you're left with this Doctor Strange that travels from reality to reality trying to consume as much magic as he possibly can.
Oh, wow.
But he's insane, and he has these big dark circles under his eyes, and it's really quite dark. My son was terrified by the episode. But to see him at the end of the trailer just goes to show you how all in Marvel is with this Disney Plus. It's no longer an experiment. They are all in on Disney Plus, more so than they ever were, to your chagrin, with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Netflix and Daredevil, because now this is the two-way street we always dreamed of. Not the TV shows looking up at the movies and the movies never looking back. This is both.
They're now all connected.
Yes,
and
really
it's called
all connected.
Doctor Strange lost, what if Doctor Strange lost his heart instead of his hands?
Thank you.
And it's, here is where you really get a glimpse of, okay, Doctor Strange could be willing to do some dangerous things to get, you know, find a way to keep his woman around.
Right, with real consequences, not like with Peter.
Yeah, nobody told him there's other fish in the sea, though, huh?
It's just so tragic and sad, though, when you watch it.
It
like,
is. It's,
it makes
a,
your
it's
heart
It's a hardcore
very sad.
Bummer. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, Aaron, I would give it that whole series. I would really genuinely give a very high recommendation.
I try to
It's very It's very low commitment. They're only 20, 25 minutes apiece.
I'll find that one. And if I am sold on that, maybe I'll go back and watch some of
the
other
think
ones.
That's the best one of all of them.
Okay. I'll give
that one
a shot.
Yeah, that one is very good.
I'll give that one a shot. All right. So, final question, then we're out of here. Do you consider this to be the best Spider-Man movie, or would you say a different Spider-Man movie is the best Spider-Man movie of the ones you've seen thus far? Adam, you're a guest. You go first.
I would still have to say the best Spider-Man movie is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, to be honest
Ooh,
with you.
Ooh, yep.
Hey, it counts. It counts.
I think that did everything this did first, without relying on nostalgia and previously established intellectual properties. That did everything on its own and told an amazing, no pun intended, story.
You're amazing.
But if I take that out of the equation, I think I still probably like Spider-Man 2 the best. I think that got everything right about Spider-Man and Peter and relationships and Aunt May and the villain. All that stuff I think kind of worked the best out of any film in that. This one I think people will say is the best Spider-Man movie because they're just really, really excited about it today. Mm-hmm. You know, history will tell whether this is the best Spider-Man movie or not.
I would agree with 100% everything Adam just said. And I also feel like there's so many things to mention that I can't believe we didn't mention this too, but they give us a hint of maybe Miles Morales being part of all of this.
Oh yeah, I love that.
In the live action.
Because I always thought he'd be black. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So great.
But there's the potential, and all of us deep inside are like, Miles, yes!
Give it time. We have a lot of years to go. Disney needs money.
So 100% agree with you, Adam.
Adam, this one I don't know. Sony owns Miles too, right?
Technically, Sony owns all of them.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah, Sony has the film rights for Spider-Man. You know, the character of Spider-Man is on loan to Marvel. You know, Marvel has creative oversights on the standalone Spider-Man films, but Sony still has the final say. And as a condition of that deal, Marvel can borrow Spider-Man for their other projects.
Yeah, for whatever the number
is. Yeah, like they do with Hulk. Hulk is always in other people's stuff instead of his own things, because Universal owns
Universal got Hulk. Yeah.
Correct.
That's why you'll never see a Hulk movie. They can't make that deal happen.
Don't need it anymore.
All of this is so convoluted. Like, we as moviegoers
we got some great movies out of it.
Sacrificing the potentials that we could have at the expense of business deals.
I don't want everything in Disney's hands.
I know. I know. It's dangerous.
We don't even need to talk about the amusement park deals with these characters.
They're crazier. That's even, even crazier. Yeah. So I'm going to say Spider-Man 1 is still my favorite because it's the first time I saw Spider-Man fly. And I was just, I mean, I remember being in the theater and almost crying. Just, no, I was crying. I was crying. Just because I had wanted to see this my whole life and I finally saw it. And I think that movie is just fantastic. Spider-Man 2 is close. This one is a great movie, but I also like, it's hard for me to say it could even be up for best Spider-Man because it only works because of previous Spider-Man movies.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
That's the only reason this works so well.
In some ways, I think that is why with like Endgame, you know, Endgame only works so well
I agree.
Because of everything that had come before. Infinity War is a better movie.
I agree.
In almost every aspect. But Endgame is the bow on the present.
Fan moments.
And that's what this is. That's what this is. This is the bow on the present of all of these Spider-Man movies beforehand.
Mm-hmm. And now
which is okay.
I can't wait till it comes out on Blu-ray, whatever, you know, 4K, whatever. And I'm going to watch all of them back to back to back just so I'm going to feel like one giant movie. It's going to be one event, one weekend. It's going to be my Lord of the Rings extended editions. All right.
Yes.
That's going to do it for this episode. Adam, anything you want to say in closing on Spider-Man?
Thank you for having me. Go see Spider-Man if you haven't already, but I think everybody already has.
Otherwise, you are spoiled to hell right now because we just told you literally everything.
Now you don't have to go.
Stay home. Save your money. Amanda, anything you want to say as we close out?
Well, I want to know if the full price of admission were $10, what are the two of you giving Spider-Man No Way Home?
$8.50 for me.
Today, isn't it all $10? I mean, it was, I don't think I could, I feel like.
Not if you went to a matinee.
Right. I feel like in a lot of ways, this is the same feeling I had when I left The Force Awakens. Mm. It's everything that I want from a Spider-Man movie. But over time, hopefully it doesn't end up on the clearance rack.
Oh, stop.
It's all $10 today.
Gotcha. That's fair.
Mm.
Amanda?
Yeah, I'm trying not to go too extreme because of nostalgia, so I'll say $8.50 as well.
Okay. Well, that does it. Thwip. We're out of here. So everybody remember, you can find The Hollywood Outsider at thehollywoodoutsider.com or on your favorite podcast app. Be sure to subscribe and come back for our normal episodes. We'll be back in January. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And remember, the next time you go to the theater to see Spider-Man, No Way Home. Buy popcorn.